You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine.
Welcome to Sponsored. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and I'm excited to bring on Glenn Plake for a third time. And on this episode with Glenn, who knows where we're going to go? Glenn takes the conversation in different directions as we talk about skiing, politics, and just about anything else that comes to mind. It'll be interesting to see where this conversation goes with Glenn Plake, the most interesting, the most famous, the most unique person in skiing. At the end of the blizzard days, they're also the infancy of the snowboard days. Snowboarding started around 85. I'm sure there was some stuff before that, but 85, Tom Sims and Jake Burton, you started hearing about them. And to you, what did you see in snowboarding when it first came out, and what are your thoughts on it now?
I saw everything that I was, what snowboarding wanted to be and was, let's say, being perceived as, was exactly what I was, and was exactly what my interpretation of skiing was, and was exactly how I was living. I was at Donner Ski Ranch when Joel from Sessions hadn't even snowboarded yet.
Huh.
He was still a skater. You know, Palmer was making his own snowboards, like out of wood, because he couldn't buy a snowboard anywhere.
Yeah, and he was part of your crew, right? That whole South Shore crew?
Yeah. I remember seeing the very first Avalanche snowboard made with Damian Sanders' brother.
Mm-hmm.
They made Avalanche snowboards in South Lake Tahoe. And they always were like, hey, Plake, you know, why don't you snowboard? And I was like, you know, I'm skiing my bumps. I'm doing my thing. But, you know, whatever. We're all hanging together. It's cool. No big deal.
Yeah, totally.
It was no big deal. You know, Donner Ski Ranch was the only place that let us do jumps and do flips. And same with Mount Rose over there above Reno. They were independently owned ski areas, and they didn't care. They just wanted people to come and have some fun. And if you wanted to snowboard, then snowboard. Fine, whatever. And everything was no big deal. And we're just kind of these weird outcasts against, you know, what was the perceived version of skiing. I don't want to blow my own horn, but I know for a fact me and Palmer invented the high back binding. We cut up some ski boots and sent him up to the Baker Mountain Slalom because he wanted to have the power of a ski boots. We cut some ski boots up and riveted to his bindings.
Huh.
We did everything we could. The glitch was, oh, you need to have releasable bindings. And we remember putting Spademan bindings on a snowboard and Palmer sneaking up on Heavenly and getting all the way up to the top before they're like, what are you doing? He's like, I got releasable bindings. And the lifties just kept letting them on. No, and everything was fine. I mean, really, everything. It was no big deal. I remember going to the old Soda Springs. Palmer didn't have a driver's license. We drove him to the Great Buttermilk Downhill, which was amazing, actually. There was a U.S. J1 Nationals the week before, and they were like, well, we're going to have a snowboard downhill, so, well, we'll just leave the course up. Dude, this is back when they were doing, you know, sandwich laminate snowboards, you know, the glorified plywood, you know, and
bolt-on edges.
Yeah, well, I think Palmer had molded edges, but it was like the first or second year of it.
Okay.
You know, no, we're all skiing and hanging out, and I was skiing, and kind of like I said last time, you know, skiing was my way to do the things I couldn't do on my skateboard. And so Evan and all the guys from Barfot used to come down and skate the ramps, and everything was fine and super cool and no big deal, honestly. And I was fine with the whole thing. It was later when, let's say, Burton and these guys started talking crap about skiing that the division started coming. And then the complete mishandling of the snowboarder, and quite frankly, the skier that nobody knew about at that time. And now alive and well in the parks and raging around. Come on, snowboard parks, but no skiers allowed. Half pipes, no skiers allowed. In this movie I did a couple years back, they said, yeah, you had a magic wand. You know, I said, I want to take it back to the day before snowboarding was invented. And everybody thought that I was feeding the fire. They didn't show was the rest of the story. And that was that it was an absolute joke how it was handled, partly because of Burton's propaganda for profit, and partly because they realized, well, let's just alienate and separate and we'll feed the fire, and part, you know, the ski areas just being complete idiots and complete jerks about what a skier could do versus a snowboarder could do. Not in a who's better thing, just the reality of, oh, he can take a jump, but I can't take a jump.
Yeah, they just didn't understand.
Now, granted, did I kind of giggle at him because they'd catch like 2 or 3 feet of air and would do like 20, 30 feet of air?
Yeah.
I ain't going to look at some snowboarder and say that's not impressive and what they've done and become. I mean, it's mind-boggling. But at the time, I wasn't that interested in transitioning because of what I was doing on my skis. That was my love. That's what I wanted to do. If I had green goggles on, should I have transitioned to snowboarding? Well, I don't know. Let's see. I had a big mohawk, a punk rocker, really good snow sense. You know, Palmer did pretty good on a snowboard. I bet I probably could have too.
It seems like you were into snowboarding when it was punk rock, do it yourself, and it's your South Shore crew. But the second it got to be corporate, we're going to slam other sports for profit, that's when you look back and said, they don't know what they're doing there, and they're just going to slam us, and they're taking my image and running with it. And it's time to separate yourself almost from that.
It was pretty funny, yeah. We joke forever, huh? You know, yeah, you know, Glenn Plank, you know, the guy with the mohawk, the snowboarder. That's always been a joke.
And I could see that. I mean, some people who have no clue just think skiing and snowboarding is the same thing.
No, it's always been the joke. And you know what? They're right.
Yeah, sliding down snow.
Sometimes, of course, I would correct them. And other times I'd just be like, you know, yeah, I'm that guy. I mean, whatever. No way, man. We'll fucking ski here, man. You know, every now and then I'd say I'm actually a skier. Like, oh, really? Are you Oh, cool. Well, anyways, yeah, they're still excited as heck. But could I have made the transition? From a career standpoint, I gave up a lot by not necessarily going down that road. Not to say that it would have changed anything. Or I gave up a lot from being the fact that because I was a skier, we were overlooked a lot in opportunities that could have come our way.
Yeah, and the money in snowboarding at that point was stupid.
Yeah.
There was a time Jeff Brushy was on Burton, but Ride Snowboards had just came out. I think it was 92, and they wanted Jeff Brushy. And I think they paid him $500,000 to leave Burton.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of those things that dug a hole for snowboarding for years because every brand had to pay the riders six figures, even though they weren't selling a lot of boards. And I think that's changed. I think it's changing every day now because of the numbers.
Well, I think we have to admire... And this is a problem with the ski industry, and it's really bad today because I am still part of this. But this whole idea of the ski industry not accepting the board sports, BMX, motocross. I mean, if we really look at action sports, it's not just board sports, but it's predominantly in the board sports. The idea that there's such a thing as a pro rider or a pro athlete endorsing your product, on your product, integrated into your marketing campaigns, bringing validity to your product. The ski industry still has not and does not embrace that wholeheartedly. Certain companies have played around with it. Part of it's not the ski industry's fault. Part of it's the athlete's fault. There's been a lot of mishandling of opportunities that people had because of bad management or bad team manager or simple abuse of that, because it's more than just getting a check and going out and being pro. If you're a competitor, of course, can base it on your winnings. But if you're not a competitor and you're more of a lifestyle representative, so to speak, there was a lot of abuse in it. But the ski industry never really has completely adopted that, where the snowboard industry did, but unfortunately probably went off the deep end. They went almost too far with it because there was some endorsements that probably didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, there was a time where you could go to the mall and see four snowboarder cutouts to get your hair cut.
Mm-hmm.
They were everywhere at some point, so it just became homogenized, the whole sport. They're able to get back to the roots now when they realize that, hey, our numbers are falling and we've got to embrace the core and spread what we know this sport is and not what Madison Avenue wants it to be.
Yeah, I mean, BMX went through it, you know, when it went kind of big. And now I'm not going to completely speak for the BMX culture or family just because I'm not part of it. But I've kind of seen it from afar where a lot of Asian manufacturing and, you know, a lot of bikes being taken away. And all of a sudden you kind of got the crew back and they're making bikes back in their own warehouses or they're running their own companies again.
With that sport, it's so hard because there's so many parts involved that you're going with third parties. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the margins are there at all. So it's really hard to support a team and stay in business. So I think that's why we've seen the consolidation in bike.
Yeah.
But you know, skiing is the old guard. You've been one of those guys that can transition and speak to any generation, but you look at most marketers, you look at most company insiders, and the people in power are still the old school ski guys.
Yeah.
And it's slowly but surely changing. SIA had a change this year and they have new leadership and it'll be interesting to see how they progress. As we see these younger people start taking power within skiing, I think it's going to be more of the skiing that we want to see.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, you forwarded me that guy's email from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You know, and he brought up that exact point. And I think to clarify what I was saying last time we chatted, of course, we've made a difference and we want to make a difference and stuff. But like I said, that old guard, it's not... I mean, I know new management positions are changing and new people are going to be in charge, and that's great. And I certainly see that. But at the same time, again, it's still there. It's still kind of that stigma of the elk medallion lunch with, I mean, I love a good lunch, don't get me wrong. But, you know, I'd probably rather just have a big old bowl of fries. I mean, I'm skiing all day, you know. It's not so much the old guard with skiing, but, you know, we're so attached to the hotel industry. I think that's different about our sport versus all these other sports, you know, is we're so attached to that hotel industry. We're so attached to that cruise ship vacation industry, which is not, in fact, representative of the sport, because now we go back to the Midwest, to little ski areas. We go back to the Donner ski ranches. We go back to the Mount Roses that snowboarding was allowed originally, or they let us do flips on our skis. I mean, I'm going to blow Mammoth's horn, but, you know, we are a privately owned, well, kind of. We're a standalone resort doing things the way we think we should do things our own way and not necessarily attached to a giant national plan that's attached to an enormous amount of hotel industry.
Are you guys going to develop a water park there?
I don't think so.
That's happening in other places.
I think water is pretty expensive. Yeah. Water is pretty expensive in California.
I think they might be doing that up in Squaw.
Maybe. I don't know. Water's pretty spendy at Squaw, too.
The KSL plans are big.
You have all these hotel, let's say, resort ski areas, but it's not the voice. You've got hundreds of little tiny ski areas scattered all through the whole country, whether it's up in the Midwest or the Pacific Northwest or the South, or, you know, I mean, that's where I get upset sometimes that we don't, I don't know, the real voice, the things we hear and see about skiing aren't necessarily that smelly old lodge.
I think you can separate the ski hills that you're talking about compared to the...
Well, there's ski areas and there's ski resorts.
Yeah, and I think the ski area has a brown bag lunch room somewhere,
sure.
And the resorts don't have that at all. If you have a brown bag, you have to pay to bring it in a room.
Very few do, but maybe as new management comes around, that you'll see that again, maybe. You know, because, I mean, I ski a lot in Europe. Who knows what king might be skiing right there, but nobody cares. You know, they're just out skiing.
Right, yeah, it's about fun.
Yeah.
But it's about money to a lot of people as well.
Yeah, without a doubt. There's a certain aspect to that part too.
Yeah. So in your career, you have been the biggest ambassador for the sport. And sometimes that ambassadorship is taken away from your skiing. And can you give us a little history on how your personal skiing's evolved? I mean, now it's more mountaineering and it's a lot different than it was in 1988.
Yes and no. Yes, of course, as I had the opportunities to explore mountains, I had a great partner. I mentioned his name before. Me and Darren Johnson walked all around in the Sierra skiing mountains that we looked at and wanted to ski down. I had a lot of influence when I was in Europe to, you know, the great extreme skiers. I was here. I saw their tracks. I saw their slopes. When I went to Japan years and years ago and was one of the first early Japanese skiers from the West, you know, and I looked at Mount Yote across from Niseko, I immediately went there and climbed Yote. When we were going for mogul camps and mogul competitions in Japan, I would always schedule a week or two longer so that I would have time to go ski touring. And I would go explore the Karamatsu and the whole Hakuba range. And then a week later, I'd be back at the mogul competitions. In 3 days, I'm leaving for Nepal, and I'll be in the Himalaya all next month doing something where I have made an adjustment in my skiing. But my general skiing hasn't really changed that much. If I took one more run, it'd be a mogul run. I'm sorry. It'd be a bump run. That would be it. That would be my last run, a bump run. For me personally, the most gratifying moments. And do I love climbing mountains? Absolutely. Do I love skiing steep slopes? Without a doubt. Do I love skiing not so steep slope, but it's part of a ski tour? Absolutely, without a question. I love every bit of it. Do I love skiing 200-foot hills in the Midwest? Yes, I do. And something that has helped me enjoy those even more, and this is the one place where I probably actually have changed my skiing, is I took on the project to become a certified ski instructor about 6 years ago. It was not given to me. I was doing some spokesperson work for the Learn to Snow Sport month there in January. And the next thing you know, they had the lady from the Today Show out skiing with me. And she was a never ever ski before, first timer. And we were at Camelback there in Pennsylvania. And she's a pretty big lady, the lady Hoda, not big lady, but she's like 6 foot, you know?
Okay.
And I'm literally like, okay, just jump on my back. You know, when you got the New York producer, like, okay, we need her up at the top of that lift right now. Let's go, let's go, let's go, New York TV. I'm all, whoa, man, this lady's never even been on skis before.
Right.
We get to the top of the lift. She goes, what's going to happen up the top here? And I'm like, I don't, you know, that's a good question. I mean, we could have the full candy cane ramp, or we could have a nice flat one. I have no idea. I've never been here before. I've never been on this lift before. I see it coming. It's sure enough, it's a ski jump because it was early in the year. And I go, look, here's what you need to do. Just grab onto me real quick. We're going to just kind of do a slow crash and just go ahead and lay down on top of me. Anyways, that night I called up PSIA and went, hey guys, you know, I'm doing all this like spokesperson stuff. You know, hey, learn from a pro, go take a lesson, free lessons at certain participating ski areas. And I'm like, I just taught a beginner and I have no idea what I'm doing. We need to clarify this message. This is something that I don't feel good about talking anymore, or certainly I'm finding myself in these positions. Another thing that happens over here in Europe, if you're not a certified ski instructor or certified mountain guide, you're not really legally allowed to accompany people, especially in a professional setting. It had come to me many, many times when we're doing a press day or something, and I'm working with a couple of mountain guides, and they go, yeah, and Glenn, you can take that group. And I'd be like, I can't actually, you guys. What are you talking about? You know, they knew I wasn't a mountain guide, but they were like, but you're a ski instructor. And I was like, I'm actually not. I'm not that either. So Remy, actually, my old friend Remy, talked me into it. He said, you should consider doing that. About that same time it happened with Ian there with Hoda. And so anyways, I called PSIA. I go, hey, what do we got to do? And they said, you got to go take a level one. I went, okay, what's that take? And they're like, well, it takes a few days. And so I did a level one instructor seminar with 200 new hires at Breckenridge.
Okay.
And in November or whatever, early December. And I did a level one, and it was really, really hard. And it was intriguing to me because I had to do things that I wasn't necessarily ready to do from a skier standpoint. And then I thought, I wonder how hard it'd be to get full certified. So I called up and I had a couple of great mentors. And I have to actually thank the Pacific Northwest Division because they really, really helped me out a lot. You guys have the strongest division up there in my eyes from education. But anyways, so I did a level two up there. I did my level three ski in Mammoth, and then I did my level three teach in Hunta, at Hunta Mountain.
Oh, nice.
Which was awesome. Anyways, there was no shortcutting. I was no different than anybody else. The only shortcuts is I was allowed. I said, I really want to, you know, go full cert, but I travel a lot. And could I do different things in different divisions? You know, I did clinics in the Northeast. I did. So I spread my membership around, so to speak. But it took me a little more than 2 years. So as far as a change in my skiing, that was a real change in my skiing to think along those lines, to read the core concepts that make PSI what it is, what they stand for, what they believe in, and then ultimately to perform the maneuvers and do the skiing that it was required to do to get the certification. Beside that, I still love skiing bumps. Ballet skiing is the ultimate as far as just having fun on a little tiny hill. And it's a terrible, terrible, sad thing that ballet skiing is not part of the sport because it's everything that the park is and more, but more usable for more people because you don't need any man-made structures or any sort of, you know, I'm really into natural skiing, honestly, and I'm not being a greenie. I don't need man's help to make a skiing experience amazing. Yeah, okay, we all love riding lifts, but once I'm going downhill, I'm fine. We can come up with some stuff. I kind of just do anything, anytime, and I love it. And 2 years ago when we had the big drought in California, and I rediscovered my love for running slalom. I ran slalom about 30 days in a row. Two pairs of skis every day. It was like Apocalypse Now or whatever, man. Every night I heard them snowmaking guns, blowing new rock-hard icy snow, and I fell asleep dreaming of bulletproof ice in the morning. I hate to say I haven't evolved because I have evolved. My skills have changed and gotten better, but what I'm into hasn't changed much. I like climbing. I like moguls and mountains.
Yeah, I think it's just what people showed of you. We did see moguls, but a lot of the stuff of you, you didn't really see big mountaineering stuff that you must have been doing the week after you were on a trip. You didn't see too much of that because back in that time, it wasn't as big to the commercial mainstream of skiing.
No, and I didn't talk about it. You can go back. There's a couple of articles. If you go way back about doing some ski touring in the Sierras, but I think they went completely unnoticed.
Yeah.
There was an old article about ski touring in the Sierras way before, and like I say, all my exploits in Japan, I just never talked about them. No reason to talk about them. It was my time. That was when I went skiing. I was out doing mogul competitions. I was teaching. I was doing those different things. We're filming movies. But when I was in the hills, that was just Glenn and a couple buddies and one buddy in particular. And that was our time. There was no reason to promote that. What we're going to promote it for, the ski boots we were using, I had made. The bindings we were using, I had made. And there was nothing to talk about. That was just us out hanging out in the hills.
Definitely not from the digital age, because those digital kids would be talking about it all day long.
Oh, gosh. They got to be careful with that, man. Mountains change in a hurry. Just because you saw a picture of it yesterday don't mean it can be done tomorrow.
Right.
Kimberly proved that years ago. We did this thing. A buddy of mine, I got the truck stuck on the way up the road, and I told my buddy, just head on up there, and we'll see you guys in a bit. We'll worry. Well, they got ahead of us and this and that, and go up there and go to find her, and can't find them. And there was one couloir that's way too steep. They know it. I didn't even go look at it. That's not where they are. I finally get back to the car. Where'd you guys go? Oh, we went to, what the heck did you do that for? It was perfect. We did it. Oh, wow. Cool. Good for you. Wow. Awesome. My buddy was pretty accomplished. Mm-hmm. Shoot, I go up there the next day and I had to wrap into the dang thing. The wind blew. So scary. So, yeah, it can change in a hurry.
Gotcha. So a couple questions in thinking to what you just said about your skiing changing in the PSIA. What does an hour of private lessons with Glenn Plake cost?
I've never played that game, so I don't know.
I would say $5,000 an hour, and I do 1 hour a year.
Usually if the truck's parked in the ski area and I'm in lip line, you just kind of yell and we go take a run. I don't care.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And that's how you've been your whole career, too, with your down-home tours.
You know, the down-home tour, that was what the down-home tour was all about, man. That's why we purposely never told anybody we were coming anywhere. And that's why we purposely showed up at night so that the next morning when people would be coming skiing, they'd be like, do you think he's really in there? I hate to say it, but we have sat in the truck and enjoyed those genuinely, genuinely real moments, you know, where we hear that. And usually if I am like sitting there listening, I'll scare somebody like, yes, he is. And I'll open the door. But that's what the down home tour was all about, man. It was my way to say thanks. And my way to say thanks, it's not what the down home tour, it's what the down home tours, because we've done 8 of them.
Yeah.
It's what they're all about, man. I just want to go ski with people that made my life possible. And the closest that I've come to play the Ski with Glenn deal or the Glenn camps or any of that stuff is, of course, I've been endorsed by some ski areas where we do a day of festival or something like that. And then I've been a big contributor to the Mammoth Mountain Ski Foundation. And we've had some pretty awesome donations made on behalf of some ski trips that I was a part of. But that would be it. I've never like put it up for sale, so to speak.
I don't know if this is fair to say or not, but I'm going to say it regardless. Looking at your career, you've never really done anything for money. I mean, yes, you've had to get contracts to pay your bills, but the choices you've made, money hasn't been the big dictator. It's always been skiing first, and the money that comes along with it is the money that comes along with it. Is that correct?
Yeah, it'd be safe to say. I mean, it's nice to be compensated. I don't have relationships with brands that aren't compensating me in one way or another. That might not be as much compensation as someone might think. To me, compensation is simply a commitment to me. And if you commit to me, then I'm going to be committed to you. It broke my heart when I saw young athletes being given these unbelievably stupid incentives, whether it's photo incentives or now in the modern age, these social media of incentive. You give you a nickel of freaking like or whatever it is. That might be great for a bonus, but that's not a basis. That's not an agreement for a relationship to build upon. And like I say, it doesn't take a whole lot, but you know, you got to show some commitment. It lets me know where I stand, lets me know where you stand. And if we go on to do great things together, then so be it. But I'm not a bank. I don't need to loan companies my talents versus money, however you want to say it. But I do believe that there should be some sort of an agreement to somebody who you want representation from.
Oh, I agree.
Then it becomes an honor to represent those people. If there is one thing that I have insisted on, it was always long term. I've never signed a 1 year agreement with anybody. It's a waste of my time. It's a waste of everybody's time. So I've always been, 3-5 year agreements. And maybe that has helped me be around as long as I have. But if the length of the agreement was more valuable than the money side of it, yes. I would always take the length of the agreement because it was just easier to deal with.
If a ski shop in New England called up, said they had a movie premiere that they really wanted you at, we're going to get your plane ticket. You're not going to be the guy who's saying, hey, so what's my day rate on this? You're going to be like, sweet, I think that day's open. I'm going to go. That's a guess. That's me speaking for you.
Honestly, I have work-inspired days with the company.
Yep.
We try to work it through the local rep or something, you know, and maybe we'll share it with two companies. Maybe each company will give them a half a day or something and be it. Honestly, there's been opportunities where the rep doesn't want to do it or the company doesn't want to free up that time, but the person still wants you to come. Well, then at that point, you got to go, okay, well, you know, what kind of day rate can we work with there? Because obviously they're trying to promote that movie for profit too. And the situation's always changing. Yes, I've had incredible great fortune, and I can't sit here and say that I haven't done things for money because my whole career I've been compensated.
But the love is stronger than the money, I feel like, for you. Just like the passion behind everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have our things, so to speak. You know, we have our apartment in Chamonix, and we have our ranch, and I'm happy to say that that has come. That has come. I haven't skied with green goggles, not very much, if at all.
It's nice to see that the love of skiing still drives everything that you do. It's not the love of the green goggles.
No, perfect example is the Down Home Tour. I wanted to do this really, really, really bad, but I needed a reason to basically say, I'm taking the winter off. Don't bother me. Well, I'm taking 2 months off in the heart of the winter. And I used my honeymoon as the excuse. And I wasn't necessarily totally fair to my sponsors because I told them I need a bunch of posters and I need a bunch of stuff and I need a bunch of stuff and da 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 da. But I never told anybody what I was about ready to do or what I had planned on doing. And we headed out off, and it was my honeymoon. Me and Kimberly loaded up the truck and hooked up the trailer and headed out across the United States with the intention of our first ski area will be as soon as, you know, we cross the Continental Divide. Then we'll start looking for ski areas.
You are so romantic.
You know, we did go to Niagara Falls. We did go to the Poconos. We did go to Gatlinburg, Tennessee and get our pictures. I mean, we did all the quintessential honeymoon things. So that's really cool. But
did you stay in a champagne glass room in the Poconos?
I have a picture of me in a heart-shaped friggin' tub. In the Poconos.
Nice. Nice. Exactly. I've always wanted to do that.
Cheese ball, man. Big old long. I can't imagine that room. It was like this weird, like, 70s porno room. I can't imagine. I was like, oh, my gosh. We're actually going to stay here tonight, too? Or are we just going to do this picture? Anyways, we go to the ski area. We had no idea what we were going to do. We just kind of showed up. First one was Hogadon, Wyoming. And we show up and we ski there and we're hanging out. We're like, oh, what are you going to do? Well, we're just here skiing and kind of hanging out. And we got a bunch of posters and we didn't really have the show yet. You know, we had no idea what we were doing. But what we did do was they asked, is there anything we can do for you? What you just did for us was quite interesting, quite amazing. We'll never forget it. And I don't either. And I said, you know what? If you could call these folks or drop them a letter. This is before email, huh? This is when you actually had to do something. I handed them a piece of paper with every one of my sponsors, the direct phone line to the president and or company manager and their address. About 2 weeks into the trip, I got a phone call from a couple of the people that I deal with and said, where are you? What are you doing? And is there any way we can help?
Huh.
And I said, here's what we're doing. We're just going to keep on going. We're looking good. I might need a poster drop somewhere as I get closer to the East Coast because everything right now is loaded up in the truck, but I think we're good. And I said, and when this thing's all said and done, do you guys mind if we split the expenses? It looks like it's going to be eight ways. Huh. And they went, no problem. And so 68 days later, we split the expenses, and I think the whole trip cost every one of them, I think it was under $1,200. I think it was like $700 or something.
Wow, that's crazy.
So no, it wasn't about the money. And that was that whole Down Home Tour was all to say thanks. And it was the beginning of something that has made an enormous impact on my career and anybody that I met along the way. I mean, it's really cool.
Well, I went to one and it was a miserable, miserable day on the summit of Snoqualmie. It was just pouring rain and you were out there.
Oh, yeah. No, we go.
So I'm going to round this out with one question because I always wanted to ask you about this. It's a ski movie. People consider Blizzard of Oz to be a game-changing movie. I consider The Guatemalan Persuader to be a game-changing movie.
Oh, my God. Dude. Okay, let's. I don't even want to talk about this right now, but because in light of the fact what I already talked about, dude, I just told you I went through my own poop. I have no poop fetish. I have a perfectly normal stool. and I'm not going to get into this. Oh, my God.
Glenn washes windows in the Guatemalan Persuader.
Oh, my gosh. The timing of that question in light of the whole story about the bridge. Yeah. So, wow. Yeah, I'm totally normal, dude. Then I eat. All right. So, Mercon. And honestly, two of the greatest movies ever made in the ski industry is Burger Time and the Guatemalan Persuader.
For sure.
And I still think to this day, I happened to be at the presentation where they showed those two movies up at Whistler during summer camps.
Okay.
And everybody was there. And it was the coolest, like, Rocky Horror Picture Show. Everybody was singing along. Omar jumped up on stage and acted out his whole section.
He was so good.
I was up there. It was literally a live show. I told Mercon, I was like, dude, you're done. You've done it. You're done. All you need to do is play one night a year at a half a dozen ski areas across the country. Don't ever make a movie. Just show these two. Audience participation. It's a show you got to see. If you haven't seen it, you got to see it. That's it.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think every skier needs to see it.
I mean, everybody was singing. Everybody knew this. I mean, you'd seen the thing 40 times if you'd seen it once.
Yep.
And yet, showed it. We did. It was like world premiere. It had been out like 2 years. Right. Classic Mercon style. Anyways, I had not been in Burger Time, and they wanted me to be a part of it. Obviously, I was kind of like a joke figure or something. And while I was in Chamonix in my early years, I happened to run across a couple of guys. One was American and one was Australian who were ski bumming in Chamonix. And the one turned us on to this little party thing called Spitting the Winkle. Apparently, it was really popular in Australia, or so he led us to believe. Oh, yeah, mate, spit the winkle. So he showed us the basics to
the ins and outs.
The spit the winkle. Kept hearing about the spit the winkle. Well, finally, apparently the night was right, and he, quote unquote, tanks up. And we're at this party, and he stands on the top balcony and spits the winkle down, like, onto the party. And it was the freaking most amazing thing I'd ever seen. We were just like, oh, my God, did you see that? And when he was telling us that, like, yeah, you tank up sometimes, you know, you can shoot it 20, 30 feet, no problem. We're just like, what are you talking about? Anyways, yeah, so I learned how to do that. Recreational enema is basically what spit the winkle is in medical terms. So Mercon wanted something special to open up his movie with, and I had been telling Mercon, I was like, you know, you guys are all partiers and you think you're all core and everything, but I don't see you guys spitting the winkle. So we thought, wouldn't it be funny if you spit the winkle into a piece of glass and that would be the opening of the film or something?
And it opens the film like no other.
Yeah, that's that. Back to my poo fetish.
It was pretty clear. It was pretty clear. I will say that.
I got a copy of it right here. I have one of the rare copies. In fact, I watched it with the entire speed team a year ago after Maribel World Championships. All the girls were here, and Nyman was here, and Marco was here, and we kind of had some bad weather, and we had a lot of people don't realize, but I have hundreds of ski films, whether they're black and white on reels or DVD and all these things, and we kind of had a movie day here at the apartment because everybody was sleeping here at the apartment, and yeah, we finished off the session with a Guatemalan Persuader, and it was actually really cool. You know, you forget, you know, with all this rail thing and all the jumping thing and all the park thing, when you go back and look at a movie like Guatemalan Persuader or any of the early films, not just the Mercon films, and you see what Tanner was doing and you see what CR was doing and you see what Rory and these guys were doing, that was a wild, wild time, man. There was some crazy stuff going on then.
Yeah, it really was.
We were all just watching, just going, man, dude, I forgot how wild that era was when you see them doing what they're doing and, you know, some of the tricks that they were doing. And I left out 100 more. We can go through the Phils. We can go through the Canadians. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and do a who's who.
Sure.
Everybody knows that those mid-90s rail and jump films were frightening to watch, even by today's standards, with some of the stuff that was being done. It's trippy, actually. So yeah, Guatemalan Persuader. And I guess Mercon's living in Florida with a fishing show or something?
I have no idea. You know, he went off radar. I was trying to get him for the podcast because I know between Burger Time and Guatemalan Persuader, he sold about 200 copies, even though it was a DVD that he could have sold thousands of.
I tell you, dude, Rocky Horror Picture Show on the road, that thing would still be playing every ski town. Be like, no way, it's this weekend? Oh man, I missed it.
There's one character that's from Mammoth that you probably have run into at some point. I think you mentioned his name. Do you have any interaction with Rory Silva?
Yeah, Rory's father was one of my, hey, I'm in town, you want to go climb a mountain, friends?
Okay.
And I've drugged Rory's dad, Buck, out and about into situations he wasn't sure about for sure. It's cool, Glenn's here. He's going to take care of us. What am I doing here? No, so I'm actually pretty close to the Silva family. I saw Rory last year during Christmas. Actually, he spoke to his dad a couple weeks ago just saying hi. And yeah, I'm pretty close to the Silva family and watched Rory go from a little kid that we built a kicker over in the trees and got him doing backflips to wow.
Yeah, he was one of the early guys that most people on this podcast, especially the first few weeks, everybody brought up Rory and like, that was one of the guys that was going to change the game.
Great era of skiing there. It fed me, you know, I mean, I get a buzz off all the crew I'm around and, you know, it fed me knowing what those guys were doing. Again, it goes back to that thing we were saying earlier about the hot doggers and that link of the chain type, you know, philosophy, which by the way, you know, we were talking about Bobby Burns and we actually have to go, sorry, I'm dragging you on, but.
No, it's all good.
We actually have to pay homage to the very first pro freestylers. And that was the old Hart team, you know, the Art Fuhrer, the Tom Leroy, the Rajay Staub, Barry Corbett was in on that group. You know, all those Summit films. I don't know if you've ever seen Ski the Outer Limits or you've seen The Incredible Skis or Mobius Flip. These were the first pro non-competition related pro skiers. And I highly recommend anybody go to the internet and buy the Summit Films DVD. I think they call it Summit Films Classics, and be exposed to a really beautiful time in the sport that really broke a lot of ice and inspired the entire hot dogging generation, which inspired our generation. And then to watch the freestylers like Rory and them grow up, and we just get a buzz off everything. I know we all get a buzz off it. I talked to Tanner about this, that when Herman Gollner did the very first Mobius flip, his brain is the same brain that I'm name dropping, but that Salerno, Airborne Eddie, their brains are the same. My brain's the same. Tanner's brain's the same. Some kid that's going to do a flip this year for the very first time in his life has got the same brain. We haven't changed that much. It's so easy to get stoked by other people's eras or accomplishments.
When you watch the films of the day, you can see the new things that people are doing and how they're taking it to the next level. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens next. People are throwing triples and, you know, it's getting more back to aerials.
Yeah.
Who knows what's next? So it's ever changing and that's great. Mm-hmm. If it stays the same, you become a dinosaur. And I think skiing saw that in the early 80s and that changed eventually once Blizzard came out. And
yep.
You're a big credit to that. So Glenn, I want to thank you for your time, man. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you guys. And thanks for listening. And I'd love to go out and ski with everybody. But in the meantime, I guess we can sit and have a yawn.
So that is the last of my three-part series with Glenn Plake, and he hasn't changed a bit. His personality is still laugh-out-loud funny, he still goes all over the place in tangents, and he still loves everything about skiing. Enough with Plake, though. We also have some inappropriate questions going on, and you'll find them at thepowellmovement.com. It's a special edition this week. I'm asking the questions, and my guest is Rachel Burks. She is bubbling with personality and should be a fun one for the question show. I want to thank you for tuning in. As always, if you have any questions or feedback for me, you can reach me at PowellMovement1 on Twitter or Mike@thepowellmovement.com. I hope everybody has got their passes and are heading up to the mountains. Enjoy, everyone. Be safe, and I will talk to you next week.